Hey, brothers, this is Didact, and we are finally back with the latest episode of the Didactic Mind podcast. This here is Didactic Mind episode 119, The Corroding Empire. A very warm welcome, as always, to all of my long-time and long-suffering Podbean subscribers. A very warm welcome to all of my long-time readers from the site. Always a pleasure to be with you. These podcasts do take a long time to record, you know, it's an hour long each time, thereabouts. And of late, I have to admit, my motivation for writing and kind of broadcasting anything has been pretty low. Not least because it feels like you're kind of saying the same thing all the time. The world sucks. Here's why it sucks. Here's what you need to do to fix it. But, you know, it's all the same stuff. And yet, the fact is, things are moving at a pace and a rate that requires explanation and exploration. And things are changing in a way that standard models that we were taught as children just don't work anymore. So we have to come up with better or alternative ways of looking at the world. Before I continue, may I just say, as always, your support means a lot to me. I really appreciate it. If you could take a look at the Buy Me a Coffee link down below, feel free to contribute if you have any spare change. It's not required. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not doing this for the cash. Really, I'm not, because if I did, well, I wouldn't have any. I don't do this for anybody really but myself. But if you'd like to contribute, please feel free. Really do appreciate it. It's a very heartwarming thing when I see it. And for those of you who don't have a VPN yet, if for whatever reason, I have no idea why you'd be in this day and age without some sort of VPN, but check out the offer from Surfshark in the description box below. Check out their associated product, Incogni. Both are very, very solid products. They are both from a company that actually tries to make your life better and actually tries to innovate and does good things for their customers, which is kind of in line with or antithetical, as it were, to some of the points that I'm going to raise in today's podcast. When I say antithetical, I mean this is a company that's actually trying to do better and trying to improve the overall experience for the user rather than making things worse, which is exactly where everything else seems to be going these days. But feel free to check out those links in the description box. Feel free to click on the Buy Me a Coffee link as well. Feel free to check out the other affiliate links in the description box and check out those products. It does help me out a little bit, and I always appreciate it whenever you do. But really, primarily, if you want to express your thanks, feel free to drop in a link or, a donation with Buy Me a Coffee. With that out of the way, let's get to kind of the point of this podcast, which is all about the growing realization. I think most of us who are in this sort of mindset, this moment in time, though certainly most of you who follow my work, are aware of the rapidly accelerating decline of Western civilization. And this is not a moment for which certainly I was prepared when I was growing up. I grew up in the 1990s, and when I grew up in the part of the world that I did, the future seemed very bright, very rosy, certainly all the way through the late 90s and even the early 2000s. Up until basically September 11, 2001. And I lived through the Asian financial crisis. I saw what it did to people. I remember how bad things were in Asia for a couple of years. But then I moved to the West, and the Western world, as it were, the advanced Europeanized world, run by essentially Europeans. Run by white Europeans at the time. And things seemed to be pretty good. You know, life was very advanced. Life was very civilized. It was very simple. The streets were clean. Public utilities were in good order. Public healthcare was for the most part, pretty solid. Life was relatively easy in the West for a very long time. And I spent much of my life in the West or in Western-style economies, Western-style countries, whether it was Australia, or Singapore, or the United Kingdom, or the United States. I always was surrounded by the West, the collective West, as it were. And as such, I came to appreciate and understand the radical difference between the way the Western world operates and the way everybody else operates. And you remember that, some of you may remember this line from Gladiator, the great movie from the early 2000s, starring Russell Crowe, in which he's sitting opposite Marcus Aurelius, played by Sir Richard Harris, Russell Crowe's character Maximus, sitting next to the Emperor. And the Emperor asks him, let us talk very simply as men. Well, talk. And then Maximus says, 5,000 of my men are sitting in the freezing mud. 3,000 of them are bloodied and cleaved. 2,000 will never leave this place. I will not believe they fought and died for nothing. Marcus Aurelius replies, and what would you believe, Maximus? And he interrupts and he says, they fought for you and for Rome. And the emperor responds, and what is Rome? And Maximus thinks for a moment and he says, I have seen much of the rest of the world. It is brutal and cruel and dark. Rome is the light. Well, that's how I felt for a very, very long time, because I lived in that world, in a world where basically you had a high trust society that functioned very well, and where you could wander around the streets late at night, wasn't a problem. You could take public transport by yourself, even as a young child, nobody would bother you. You could rely on the public services to be safe, clean, and orderly. You could rely on public utilities. You could rely on the plumbing system. I mean, something as basic and as critical as that, you could rely on it. The sewage system in the average big city was highly functional. If you open up the tap in an advanced Western economy, the water that comes out is quite drinkable. People who live in the West don't understand how unusual this is. You really don't. And you have to spend some time living in other parts of the world, less salubrious parts of the world, to understand just how strange this is. That you can literally go to a tap in your kitchen, open it up, and the water that comes out is perfectly safe to drink. If you tried that in India, or in most Asian countries, or in much of South America, or in just about any part of Africa, you would be anywhere from extremely sick to extremely dead within a few days because of the parasites and diseases in the water. Westerners do not understand how good they have it. They really don't. But I think many of you are beginning to realize this as you're watching the corrosion and the collapse of your civilization. Now, the pattern of that collapse is not, you know, all at once. It's not sudden. It's a gradual wearing away of the underpinnings of your society, of the moral foundations, the fabric that ties everything together, leading to a spiritual decay, or actually caused by a spiritual decay. You know, it feeds on itself. The moral foundations wear out. The spiritual fabric that binds everything together is gone. And that, in turn, eventually and always leads to a physical collapse. Because just as in war, there are three levels to war. There's the physical, the mental, and the moral. The same really applies to civilizations. There's a physical level of civilization. There's the mental level, and then there's the moral level at the top. And when you lose the moral level, everything else falls apart. And it can fall apart slowly, or it can fall apart quickly. In the case of the West, things seem to be falling apart very, very quickly. Now, the title of this podcast is The Corroding Empire. Some of you who've been around for a little bit may recognize where this comes from. There was a bit of a kerfuffle about, oh, I don't know, 8-9 years back, let's say about 9 years ago, where it was about 2016, 2017, thereabouts, that sort of time period, from what I remember, wherein basically John Scalzi, the sci-fi author behind the Robert A. Heinlein ripoff, Old Man's War, unduly celebrated for really quite mediocre literary accomplishments, as far as I'm concerned, but whose greatest claim to fame is essentially that he is good at ripping off the styles of much greater authors than himself. John Scalzi is an uber gamma. I mean, just a colossal gamma, and has been called out as such publicly in his long-standing feud with our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, peace be unto him, Voxemort the Most Malevolent and Terrible. And Vox Dei has repeatedly and routinely disparaged Scalzi, not without reason, as it happens. I actually agree entirely with our Supreme Dark Lord's sentiments on the subject, but then I agree with him on just about everything. He really takes Scalzi to task on the issue of, just being a very bad writer, and, of course, on his very low sociosexual status, which, if you look at everything in Scalzi's life, there's no question of it. He fits the gamma pattern absolutely to a T. There's not even any doubt about it. Scalzi wrote a book around the time period I'm describing, so the 2016-2017 period, called The Collapsing Empire. And just as Old Man's War was kind of his remix of Heinlein, of the sort of juvenile / Starship Troopers era, that was when Heinlein was at his most astonishing, his most creative, his most masterful, and brilliant, really. I mean, I've read all of the juveniles. I've read Starship Troopers multiple times. The ideas and the concepts he describes in those books are phenomenal. And the creative vision of the man was incredible. It was off the charts. He really was a grandmaster of science fiction. Scalzi was now trying to rip off a different author, Isaac Asimov. And Collapsing Empire was essentially Scalzi's take on the Foundation series. And if you've read the Foundation series, you'll know that the first book, Foundation, is all about how Harry Seldon predicted through this, arcane mathematical art called psychohistory, the pending collapse of the Galactic Empire. And there are certain passages, particularly in the first sort of one-third of the book, not even that, actually, the first one-fifth of the book, thereabouts, in which Harry Seldon, Asimov through Harry Seldon's voice, talks about the way empires stagnate and end. And I never read Scalzi's book. I've never been interested in his writing beyond sort of the various snippets and excerpts that Vox Dei has posted. But it was apparently pretty bad. And it was like, well, Vox Dei basically said, this is ridiculous. What is the point of having a writer like this on your staff? So at the time, Castalia House, I think, did as kind of an in-joke within their own ranks, put together a book really quickly, within a couple of weeks, basically, designed specifically to mock Scalzi's book as a straight-up, rip-off, a pastiche, a parody of it, and put it out there on sale on Amazon. And then there ensued this whole ridiculous, hilarious, actually, saga of Scalzi issuing a takedown order, Amazon taking it down, then putting it back up and taking it down again, then parody books being released one after another to mock Scalzi and then to mock Vox Day. And then, yeah, it was gloriously stupid and hilarious at the same time. But the funny thing about the book that mocked Scalzi's book was that it was called several different things. I remember the first version was called Corrosion. The second one was called The Corroding Empire. And then I think they finally settled on Corrosion, The Corroding Empire, Book 1. And the subsequent Book 2, Book 3, that never came out. That project sort of stopped dead in the water after the first book. But I remember the first book being actually a semi-competent and decent attempt at science fiction. Because what it said was, essentially, the Galactic Empire, or whatever the proxy was in the book's universe, the empire of that time was subject to some sort of virus, essentially. And that virus spread out and kind of destroyed everything. It destroyed all of the various mechanical and artificial intelligence systems in the galaxy, resulting in galactic-wide civilization collapse. The reason this is interesting is because it ties directly into a phenomenon we've observed in the Western world to a very great extent over the last 5 to 7 years. And it comes from an idea put forth by one Cory Doctorow, and you may have heard of it. It's called the enshittification of everything. Enshittification, and you'll have to forgive me for the profanity, but what is enshittification? He defines it as, in an article for Medium.com, this is a direct quote from the article, it's a way to describe, it's a term used to describe the way that platforms decay. And what is enshittification? Why did it catch fire? I'm quoting Doctorow now. It's my theory explaining how the internet was colonized by platforms and why all those platforms are degrading so quickly and thoroughly, and why it matters, and what we can do about it. And he goes on to say, we're all living through the enshittocene, a great enshittening, in which the services that matter to us, that we rely on, are turning into giant piles of shit. Why does this matter? Why is this important? Because what he's describing, enshittification, as it were, is not in and of itself a cause. It is a symptom of a broader moral and mental decay, a disorder that is afflicting the entire Western world. You can see it all around you. You can see it every day if you're living in a Western city. And I do live in a Western city, and I know what it's like. I've lived in many Western cities in my life, and I've seen what happens when the values and morals and ideals that underpin a society come unstuck. The society itself comes unstuck. And that is exactly what we're seeing now. The phenomenon of enshittification, as it were, is merely a manifestation of the broader cultural decay we're experiencing in the West. And again, I have to really take people to task in the West for living in a delusion bubble, because I've spent quite a lot of time outside the West in the last 6 years. I was forced to. I had to leave the United States. And I lost my job, and I've talked about this extensively. I've talked about what that did to me and how it shaped my subsequent worldview, and how coming to Christ also shaped it. When I look around the world and I look at the way the rest of the world thinks, and having traveled extensively through it for the last 5, 6 years, I think I have a pretty good understanding, at least at a somewhat deeper than surface level, of how non-Western nations, but still quite advanced nations, think and act. And I look at how the West thinks and acts. It is very obvious to me why the West is going down the tubes as fast as it is. The first dimension of this decay is, and the most important dimension, is spiritual. The West has lost its spiritual foundations. When you go back to the 1950s, the world of the 50s was profoundly different from today in the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, all of Europe. I mean, Europe was perhaps a bit different because Europe had just gone through the harrowing of the Second World War, both World Wars, actually. And so the culture of Europe was traumatized to a degree that the rest of us can barely understand. But if you look at the world of the 50s, people were, I mean, the nations themselves, first and foremost, the nations themselves were like 95% Christian, 90 to 95% Christian, and 90 to 95% white and European. That world no longer exists. If you look today at, let's say, the United Kingdom, the UK is less than 30% Christian. The last time I checked, it may well be even lower than that. It could be as low as 20%. If you look at cities like London or Manchester or Birmingham or Liverpool, their urban populations are less than 60% white European. London is less than 50%. Manchester, in the sort of Manchester city, is about 60%. Liverpool, I haven't looked up the statistics for a while, but I would imagine it's somewhere around the same. There are entire cities in the United Kingdom which are basically Pakistani and Indian enclaves. And it's getting to the point where there are actual open ethnic riots between different groups of South Asians. If you look at their elite colleges, Oxford, Cambridge, LSE, Imperial, Manchester, University of Manchester up north, various others across the country, part of the big Russell group, they used to churn out graduates who were European. They were white, they were Christian, and they would go into kind of standard career paths that were designed to perpetuate the institutions that kept the United Kingdom safe and strong. The same was true of the United States. If you looked at all of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant universities, I mean, that's exactly what they were. They were WASP enclaves, and the people that they produced were aristocratic WASPs who would go into aristocratic WASP institutions. But there was always a sense, at least looking back on it, that I can see from the writing, from the culture of the time, that there was always an expectation they would carry on the business of maintaining these institutions, of maintaining this culture. All of that is gone. If you look at those elite institutions today, certainly in the United Kingdom, certainly in the United States, these are now essentially ways or tickets for well-to-do and even not so well-to-do families from the rest of the world to find entry into the Western world, to take advantage of Western norms and Western civilization, because the countries they're coming from don't have those norms and don't have those niceties. They don't have those good things that the West does. Well, the thing people keep forgetting, and both sides of the equation are responsible for this, both the people coming in and the people letting them in are responsible for this failure of understanding. The thing that they both sides fail to understand is those institutions and those facilities and that infrastructure all came about because of the sacrifices and investments made by the original white Christian inhabitants of those countries. And the people who are coming in to replace them have no interest in maintaining those things. And it's not difficult to see this in action in the West. you go to parts of Gothenburg or Malmö in Sweden, they're like whole no-go zones where people just, the police can't even go in there. It's impossible for them to go in because these are essentially ethnic and racial and religious enclaves where white police are not permitted. There's no trust in society anymore. There's no sense of togetherness in society. And you really have to go to some place that isn't like this to understand how much the West has lost. So that's where I'm coming from. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Russia, and I am unusually privileged in that I'm a Westerner who is able to travel to Russia. I speak some Russian, not very well, admittedly, but I do speak some Russian. And the trip before last, I was able to open up a Russian bank account via actually a Western bank that's still based in Russia. I won't go into which one. There are a few of them. But because of that, I am able to see what life is like in Russia relative to what it's like in the West and do a comparison of the two. And comparison is the great illustrator of what is true and what is not. Because when you are able to compare two things, it reveals characteristics of both that you can then use to understand what is correct and what is right. The interesting thing about being in Russia is some of you may well be old enough to remember what life was like in the United States or the United Kingdom or Australia, New Zealand, or any Western country in the late 1950s to early 1960s. So before the sexual revolution kicked off, before the baby boomers really grew into maturity, before essentially American society, Western society went straight to hell. If you remember what those times were like, and you take that sort of social model and you transplant it across the ocean into Russia, that's what it's like living in Russia. It's very interesting to go over there. Now, there are differences, don't get me wrong. It's not like you just did a time warp of everything that was the 1950s and zoomed into 2024 Russia. That's not the case. If you look at modern Moscow, for example, which is where I spend most of my time, that is by far the most liberal city in Russia. St. Petersburg is probably a close second, but it's a much smaller city and has less by way of, I would say, Western influence. So, that's not true. Less by way of Western political influence. It probably has more by way of somewhat Western cultural influence because it is, after all, the city of artists and musicians in Russia. But Moscow is by far the biggest city in Russia. It's the biggest city in Europe. I mean, 13 million people in the metropolitan area alone. And so what you see in Russia is a sense of a country, even through a very liberal lens, that has rediscovered its sense of purpose and pride and self. And you see the roots of a very, very strong, very deep culture. You see a culture that has been through literal hell through communism and has come out the other side much more unified and normal as a result. In some ways, going through that communist paradigm and that the hell times of Bolshevism somehow inoculated Russia from the evils of wokeism and globalism that have overtaken the West. Keep in mind, and this is where the spiritual dimension of things comes in, and I referred to this earlier. Keep in mind that Russia has been Orthodox Christian nation for over 1,000 years. In, I think it was 988 AD, Prince Vladimir I of Kiev at the time baptized the entire Kievan Rus. The Kievan Rus became a baptized nation of Orthodox Christians. And because of that, I really do firmly believe that because he not only baptized himself, but his entire people, and those people then spread throughout the lands of the Rus and eastwards toward Asia, in a gradual, accretive, syncretic fashion, kind of exporting their culture, not just through open conquest, but through trade and education and missionary outreach and voluntary union agreements. That is why the nation of Russia has been protected for as long as it has. Keep in mind that what we call wokeism, or the modern ideology of the woke today, is really just Bolshevism in a new form. And not just Bolshevism, but a very particular and very evil strain of Bolshevism. It is Trotskyism, and it was Russia that expelled Lev Trotsky. It was not an accident that Lev Trotsky was a Jew, a secular Jew who hated his own people, and who sought global revolution by abandoning all of the old mores and standards, and moving toward a world in which the state controlled everything. And that was the kind of communism that Stalin expelled from the Soviet Union. I'm dramatically simplifying things, I realize, but this is more or less what happened. That Trotskyism exported itself to the United States and other countries in the form of what we now call today neocons. If you look at the intellectual and family histories of the people who became the neo-clowns, many of them trace their origins back to Jewish families, secular Jewish families, kicked out of what is now today Novorossiya, as it happens, Bessarabia back in the day. And they have hated Russia ever since. They have hated the Russian people ever since. It is not accidental that when you go and look at the family histories of people like Victoria Nuland, and you look at Meyer Nudelman, her grandfather, that is a classic case in point of an extremely damaged man who passed extremely damaging ideas and ideologies down through his family line. So what you see today is a nation that is in Russia, very similar to what was lost in the 1950s and 60s. And it's not perfect, not at all. I mean, there are some very, very dangerous pathologies in Russia, which people need to see and understand for themselves. And they do have serious social problems. But when you walk around, you see a very normal, healthy society. When I was there and I was walking around, I felt completely safe, in a way that I do not feel in any Western city. I mean, literally completely safe, in the sense that, you know, you could be in any part of Moscow and you could be walking on the streets at 3 o'clock at night and nothing would happen to you, because it's that kind of city. It's not because there are police everywhere. There aren't. Although, okay, that being said, I did notice a heavier than usual police presence this time around. And the reason being, I traveled to Russia a few weeks after the Crocus City Hall attacks. So, of course, by definition, there were more police on the streets. I did actually get asked, I did get stopped on my first day there and asked, you know, where are your papers? And here's my passport and my immigration card. Well, where's your registration? Well, I only just arrived today. Oh, okay then, fine. Off with you. And that was it. I mean, that's the only time I was ever stopped while I was in Moscow. As long as you keep your papers with you and as long as you're legitimate, you've got nothing whatsoever to fear. I mean, the police might take a look at you and say, documenti, пожалуйста, and hand over your documents. I'll read it. Okay. Спасибо. Хорошего дня, that sort of thing. And you're on your way. But this is a very different world from what you find in the West. When the police operate in Russia, they actually crack down on criminals. They don't crack down on people, you know, making fun of others on the internet through memes. They do, and this comes back to this issue of pathologies. There is a strong undercurrent, or actually it's not even an undercurrent, there's an overt action against religious blasphemy. This is both good and bad, because the anti-blasphemy laws which they enforce are about people who hurt the sensitivities of religious believers. So there's a case not too long ago, some months back, of a woman who basically went topless in front of an ancient Russian church in central Moscow, an ancient Orthodox church. Her boyfriend or companion or whatever took a photo of her, and she was dumb enough to post it on Instagram. Again, as I said, Moscow is probably Russia's most liberal city. And the police found out about it and questioned her. And the Orthodox Church actually was the one that said she should be forgiven and let's not, you know, overreact and all that. So they were the ones trying to pour oil on troubled waters. But actually, the Russian police do take such things very seriously. So that's the good thing. The bad thing is, of course, you cannot have open debates with, for example, Muslims about their faith. Now, Russian Muslims are very moderate relative to other Muslims that you find elsewhere in the world, like Pakistanis. Pakistani Muslims are some of the most fanatical you'll ever meet. Nigerian Muslims, Moroccan Muslims, even many of the Saudi Muslims are nowhere near as bad as some of these other groups, because you can sort of reason with the Arabs, but for some reason, the Pakistani Muslims, like, they have absolutely no ability to accept any form of disagreement or criticism of their religion. And you compare and contrast the way of life in Russia with the way of life in the West. When I talk about, you know, Muslims in the West, Islam in the West is in a state of crisis. That's true. You wouldn't know it by looking at it from the outside. It is actually in a state of crisis. And the reason it's in a state of crisis is because Muslims come over from the sort of crap hole countries of the world into the, for now, much more advanced and normal and well-run West. And they come here and they settle here, and, you know, particularly the young Muslims find a huge cognitive dissonance between what their so-called belief system teaches them and what they see every day, which is much more liberal, much more open, much more free, and much more encouraging of questioning and inquiry, you know, actual freedom of thought, at least for now, until the West completely falls prey to the woke mind virus and is destroyed. But they see that and they go one of two ways. Either they start questioning their beliefs, or in the majority of cases, they experience severe cognitive dissonance and kind of shut down their minds to the open, blatant, glaring contradictions in their belief system versus what they actually encounter in the real world. In Russia, these contradictions aren't so severe. And it's really interesting as to why. Muslims in Russia are actually quite moderate. When I was in Dagestan last August, it was really fascinating. I was walking in the streets of Mahachkala, the capital city of Dagestan. It's very normal to see a beer house, literally, you know, pivny bar, on the street. And it's quite open. People can go in, they can order a drink. It's not like hidden in any way. It's not like when you go to Dubai, there are these alcohol shops that you have to kind of, these windowless rooms where you can actually buy booze, but you can only go in with a special, like, red card permit or something. And it costs you money from the government to do that. So the only places where foreigners can drink alcohol are in the really fancy hotels and restaurants. So they charge you 4 or 5 times the actual price that you would normally pay. So, and that's why if you're living in Dubai, by the way, people get this colossal 4-liter allowance. So if you've got friends living in Dubai and you go to visit them, don't be surprised when they tell you, dude, stock up on booze when you get into the duty-free shop and buy as much as you can, you know, as much beer and as much wine, as much whiskey, bring it over and we'll pay you back for it and that sort of thing. So, you know, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing a corrosion of society in the West that doesn't exist elsewhere. And it's happening, first and foremost, as I pointed out earlier, because of a spiritual failure. The West has moved decisively away from Christianity. if you look at the UK, you look at Australia, you look at New Zealand, whatever else, there is a decided move away from the moral and spiritual underpinnings of the Christian faith. And this has been disastrous. The reality is the Christian faith in Europe has never recovered from the open attacks by the German Tübingen school in the 1800s against the Bible. Because this was back when a lot of new scientific discoveries, archaeological discoveries were coming forth, and they were really challenging the Bible and its historicity and its factual basis. And Christians had long taken the Bible for granted as an absolute truth, as a completely truthful text. So they hadn't quite done their homework as a consequence. And when these new atheistic lines of attack started coming up, Christians didn't have a basis for response. They weren't able to respond easily. It took decades for us to start blunting those attacks and for more evidence to come up, more data, more manuscripts, more archaeological dig sites to come up to show, in fact, our record of history in the Bible is the truth, and that everything we know and we believe and we can attest to from our texts is true. It was very, very difficult for the church in Europe to recover from this because, for whatever reason, the apologetic shield around Christianity in the West has failed. And I don't really know why. I'm inclined to say that a big part of it was because of the Catholic Church's magisterium being, you know, as unwieldy a structure as it is. I mean, when you get all of your truth from one source, which basically says, well, you know, we're not going to get into this whole discussion or debate between science and the Bible. We accept what the scientists say on the one hand and biblical truth on the other. We're not going to see the overlap between them. Well, that's a cop-out, in all honesty. It really is. It's just a cop-out. And that holds for the Catholic countries. And it's also a reality that most Catholics and most Orthodox Christians, for that matter, don't read their Bibles. They just don't. I am shocked. I'm absolutely shocked by the number of Catholics that I've encountered who've never actually cracked open the Bible and read the Old Testament. Most of them have no clue, absolutely no idea, that the Bible itself teaches the existence of many gods, small g, but the existence of only one God, big G, creator. That all the small g gods are the product of the creation of the universe and are in open rebellion against big G God. Now, these are the watchers described in the book of Genesis and in much more detail in things like the book of Enoch. So people who don't do that Bible study have no basis for their faith. Frankly, they just don't. I mean, you can argue with me all you like, but the reality is if you don't read the text and you don't make the effort to understand what the text is telling you, you simply won't have a clue as to what the Azazels are referred to in the Pentateuch. Why is it that, where does the term scapegoat come from? It literally comes from the Bible. It comes from the fact that the Israelites were supposed to release a goat into the wild to satisfy the demon of the wild. I mean, literally, the Azazel. Why does that exist? Well, the Bible tells you why it exists. When you lack that firm moral foundation, it should not then become a surprise that you have this corrosive influence of very dangerous other entities or other beings coming in. And that is exactly what we see in the West today. In many ways, what you're seeing in the corrosion of the Western Empire, and the West is an empire. It's no longer an alliance of nations. It is a true empire. The corrosion is coming from spiritual influences from outside that Christianity is no longer protecting against. And the ironic thing is Christianity is springing up everywhere else. Christianity is apparently the fastest growing religion in Iran. And the mullahs of Iran recognize they've got a very severe problem. They know the apostasy rates in Iran are through the roof. They know the apostasy rates in Saudi Arabia are through the roof. It is across the entire Islamic world, outside of the West, apostasy rates and conversion rates, you know, moving away from Islam toward Christianity, are skyrocketing. Now, why is that happening? Because a lot of Muslims, thousands of them every day, are seeing Jesus appearing in their dreams and beckoning them back to Him, the truth. Muslims have a completely mistaken understanding of Jesus. They call Him Isa in their scriptures, and it's totally mistaken. It's a pastiche of Yeshua, or Yehoshua, or Joshua, or whatever you want to call him, but you know, Yeshua is his proper name. And the version of Jesus they have in their Quran is completely wrong. It's based on 2nd century Gnostic texts and Nestorian Christian texts and Ebionite Reform Judaism texts, you know, so it's all a mishmash of weird stuff. But Jesus is coming to them in their dreams. So just as we're seeing Christianity collapsing in the West, we're seeing it reviving everywhere else. And that is why, you know, in Russia right now, for example, there is a massive Christian revival underway. Most people don't know this. There are churches being built in Russia every single day. And God honors this fact by providing protection and blessings to a nation that even if it only obeys Him religiously rather than spiritually and morally, because remember, Russia still has a very severe problem with divorce and a very severe problem with adultery and a serious problem with abortion, although those things are on the way down. And Russia's total fertility rate is still nowhere near what it needs to be for a growing population. Russia is still, in a very real sense, protected against the woke mind virus. If you try to display any kind of LGBTQ WTF is this shit propaganda in Russia, you will be arrested. It's not just, you know, peddling stuff to minors anymore. I mean, they clamp down on that really hard. Anything along the lines of any kind of promotion of this very nasty lifestyle, the Russian authorities will come after you. And they will arrest you, and they will fine you, or they will put you in prison. They are very serious about the law over there, and they are very serious about protecting their people from blasphemy. That is something you don't find in the West anymore. So when you look at this, the corroding empire, what is happening and where is it going? Well, the corrosion is deep. It's deep-rooted, and it's eating away at the very foundations, the very fundamentals of Western society. And it's not going to stop until the West simply collapses from its own internal contradictions. I want to make it very clear. I don't think there's any hope of saving the Western nations as they are now. I think they're doomed. I mean, and this is a big change in my attitudes from just a few years ago. I thought when Trump was elected in 2016, that was a great chance for America to save itself. But Trump, you know, despite what I think of the God Emperor, and I still view him very, very positively, Trump was simply not up to the task. In fairness, I don't think anybody was up to the task. The magnitude of the problem, the problems are so great in the United States, I don't think anyone can come along and save it. America is no longer the nation. It's no longer a nation at all. It hasn't been for a very long time. I talked a lot in this podcast about how Russia is very similar to America in the 1950s and 60s. To bring America back from the brink would require moving back to a nation of the 1950s and 60s. Think about what that would entail. In 1960, the population of the United States of America was something like 178 million, thereabouts, you know, give or take a few million here and there. It was about half the size of what it is today. It was like 90% white, and it was at least 90% Christian. Going back to that status would require the forced deportation of 50 million illegal aliens. 50 million with an M. Going back to not just that's just getting back to like a law-abiding, normal functioning society where a border means something and where immigration laws mean something and where you're not paying out constantly in huge amounts of welfare to immigrants, aliens, invaders who are essentially transforming the country from the inside. Getting back to a system ruled of self-rule and self-governance with the demographics of the 60s would require deporting or disenfranchising, and at minimum disenfranchising, about 100 million other people. These are impossible changes. It is not possible to do these things. And nor should it happen at this stage, because what is coming is judgment. I'm not saying this with any kind of pleasure. I assure you, this is not fun for me to say. I lived in the United States for a long time. I feel profoundly blessed and really, you know, I was given this incredible gift to live in the United States as long as I did. I have deep and abiding personal affection for Americans, especially rural Americans, who have always treated me very, very kindly. I've always felt very welcomed in the U.S. I've always felt like, you know, this was the one country on earth where it didn't really matter what I looked like, didn't matter how I spoke, it didn't matter what my background was. I could drive to any part of the U.S., anywhere I wanted to go, and I would be treated kindly and decently, and nobody would bother me as long as I obeyed the law. It's a wonderful feeling. And it's only when you leave the U.S. and you travel a little bit around the rest of the world that you realize how rare, how unusual that actually is. It's completely bizarre to most people, actually, to treat others that way. You'll find it in Russia. If you wander around Moscow, yeah, you'll see black people, you'll see Asians, you'll see Chinese. I saw quite a lot of Chinese, actually, during this trip. I saw quite a few Indians. I saw quite a few Nigerians. On the Moscow metro, it's about 70-80% white Russians, yes, and you know, some Asiatic Russians as well. The overwhelming majority of them speak Russian, but you did hear a little bit of Chinese, a little bit of Korean, a little bit of whatever African languages they spoke, some small smattering of English, not much. I stuck out like a sore thumb because I'm very obviously not white. I'm very obviously not a Russian native speaker. I'm talking to somebody next to me in English. But nobody ever treated me badly. I mean, everyone was very nice to me. Everyone was very respectful. As long as I spoke Russian, which I do, and I was able to make my way around and ask questions and order things, no problems. No, nothing. No issues whatsoever. You do get that feeling in Russia, but you don't get it in most of the rest of the world. It's very important for Westerners to understand this. You've got to get out of your delusion bubble. You've got to get out of this bubble that says the West is the best and it's always going to be the best. It's not. The West has fallen. It's not falling, it has fallen. And there is no going back from this. All the great good that existed in the West, if you look at Europe and the priceless, wonderful legacy of intellectual accomplishment, of scientific advancement, of art, of beauty, of literature that exists in Western Europe, it's all going to become a sideshow now, because the West is no longer the West. It's imported too many people from outside the West who have nothing in common with the West and no longer want to be ruled by the West. These people want to be ruled by people who are like them. This is why mass immigration is exactly the same as war. It's the same end result. Vox Dei was right when he proposed this thesis back in, I think, 2015, whenever it was. And he's right today. And it's not just him saying it. Martin van Creveld, one of the greatest living military historians, has said essentially the same thing. It comes down to the same idea. And this is the problem. The West has let itself get trapped into a cycle of vicious self-loathing. and at the same time is no longer ruled by its own people. The combined Jewish and foreign elites that rule over much of the West, not all of it, but much of it, do not have a connection to the peoples of the West. And for that reason, they are very happy to kind of abuse the systems and institutions that created the West to consolidate their hold on power. That's why when you look at when you look at the political situation in Britain or the United States, it doesn't matter, like Italy, Spain, Greece, France, Germany, it doesn't matter where you look in the West, Australia, the political parties are all the same. They say the same things, they do the same things, there's no difference between them. It doesn't matter whom you vote for. There is no way to vote yourself out of this conundrum. There is no hope of fixing the problem within the current political framework. It's not going to happen. And we need, you know, those of us on the Christian nationalist right, those of us who believe in, who love our nations, not ultra-nationalists. So there's a big difference between being a nationalist and being an ultra-nationalist. A nationalist loves his country and respects other countries and cultures. I am a nationalist. Ultra-nationalists hate everybody else's countries and cultures. The people who run Ukraine today, they are ultra-nationalists, and they are very, very evil. Those of us who are of the Christian nationalist right and who believe in a Christian nation governed on Christian principles with the principles of the Ten Commandments as our guide and the word and the law of Jesus as our foundation, those of us who believe in that need to understand this. There is no way to vote yourselves out of this. Not going to happen. So stop deluding yourselves. This corrosion that exists in the Western Empire is a deep-rooted problem that you cannot simply excise through changing the leadership. The leaders are all the same. They are not of the people. They have no skin in the game. They have no desire to improve things because the way things are makes them rich. It makes them powerful. Why would they want to change it? It's good for them. The only way out of this is to go back to what worked at the fall of empires. I'll finish off with one point that's worth remembering. If you haven't seen it yet, go watch the interview between Tucker Carlson and Tucker Max. You know, Tucker interviews Tucker. It's a great interview. It's an hour long. Tucker Max has undergone a profound transformation, and he's very obviously a much more intelligent man than what I thought when I first encountered him, you know, 10 plus years ago, through his book. I never read the full book. I read some passages, like the beginning couple of chapters, and I thought it was pretty funny, but, you know, a bit stupid. He struck me as a bit of a douchebag, and he admits he was a douchebag. But he talks a lot about how the fall of empires affected some people very badly and other people not at all. The people who weren't affected were the ones who created strong communities around themselves. This is what we need to do as Christian nationalists. We need to find our communities. We need to rally around them. We need to build our own churches outside of the mainline churches, which have all failed. They've all fallen, except to some extent the Russian Orthodox Church and a few others, but not many. They're all broken. They're all corrupted. So why would we resort to that when we have the very clear Word of God in the Bible? And it pointing to the true Word of God, the Logos, Jesus himself. Why would we want to listen to the Roman Catholic Church incorrectly explaining the Logos, or the Orthodox Church incorrectly explaining it? Why not read it for ourselves and make up our own minds? And it's important to understand, God loves the nations. The nations will be there at the end when Jesus comes back. So this corrosion, to conclude, is not going to go away. It's going to result in the fall of the West. It's then going to move on to other places. But we who are left behind need to prepare ourselves for it by preparing our communities. And with that, let me end. Hope this has been an interesting and somewhat, hopefully, enlightening discussion. As always, please remember to like, comment, share, and subscribe, especially if you have not done so. And be sure to check out the links for Surfshark and Incogni in the description box. And check out Buy Me a Coffee as well if you would like to support my work. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 119, The Corroding Empire. And this is Didact, wishing you strength and honor, brothers. Over and out.